Well, if you look at the general impression of Pakistan, of the world outside and the people inside, it seems superficially that it's a primitive society, a country created on the base of religion, a theocratic state, with all the reaction and fundamentalism dominating society at every aspect. And it's also the new generation in Pakistan which does not know the real history of the workers, the peasants and the youth, how they entered the arena of politics and destiny to struggle for an emancipation of their lives. Well, Pakistan has a history of 64 years. The history of the people of Pakistan is of just 139 days. And that glorious chapter, that glorious period that belongs to the workers and peasants and youth of that country has been obscured, not just by the ruling class, not just by the right wing, but most of the left and the Stalinists, who never seriously believed that the people could rise up and challenge the system that existed. And it's not an accident that it was this international who recognized, like today, 42 years ago, 43 years ago, that what was taking place between 6th of November 1968 and 25th of March 1969 was nothing less than a social revolution. And I think, if I'm correct, it was sometime in December, January 1968-69 when Alan wrote an article in London explaining that why that movement was a revolutionary upset. But before we go into the events and the dynamics of what happened in that period, in that revolution, we have to go into the background and history of the independence struggle and the class struggle that came with it. Now, the British ruled the South Asian subcontinent for 200 years. For 200 years. And before that, there was a socio-economic structure of society was mainly of a very unique character. It was an Asiatic mode of production, not classical feudalism that we see in the historical materialism in Europe. And I think Marx started to work on that, but then he was, after 1858-59, he started to involve himself in the capital and could really continue the analysis of Asiatic despotism or Asiatic mode of production. And because India was known as the land of flowing milk and honey, the fertility of the land attracted invasions, and there have been a whole spate of invasions for 2,000 years. And most of the invaders who came were from relatively primitive cultures and relatively primitive regions. And when they came into India, they invaded India, they conquered India. But due to the richness of the culture, they were all absorbed into the culture and became part of society. But India was never a united entity before the British came. India was never a united entity before the British came. And the British were the only invaders who conquered India but were not absorbed into the culture and society as such, because of the Industrial Revolution had transformed their cultural and social. And one of the reasons that they could compete with the French and the German and other relatively newer bourgeois revolutions, the bourgeoisie that developed out of it, that they got enormous surplus out of their exploitation of India to put it into their industry and technology to compete with other imperialist powers of that period. But it was the British who laid the railway lines, who put up the telegraph and the railway, the telegraph and the communications network and the investment by British for imperialist reasons. It was the first time that India attained a unity as a national, on a national basis. But after the main War of Independence of 1857, the struggles, there were many struggles, but none that could really challenge the British imperialist rule. But it was the Russian Revolution of 1917 which really gave a new impetus, a new vigor, a new courage to the fresh proletariat that had developed under the British rulership and British industry, that really invigorated the whole national liberation struggle. But all the history of independence taught in India and Pakistan and even I think in British history books is quite far from reality. They don't bring in the class content and the class conflict that was inherent in that national liberation struggle. Very interesting to note that on 28th of May 1929, the main mouthpiece of the British imperialism, the Times of London, wrote an editorial. And that editorial said that there are not one movement of liberation in India. There are two movements of liberation in India. And they said that one is the movement of the political leaders who like Gandhi and Jinnah and Nehru, but the other movement is a movement of the labor. And they praised Lord Irwin to take when he was taking those repressive steps against the labor movement. And they said that Lord Irwin was right, who was a viceroy in India, to crush that movement, which is more dangerous to us than the movement led by Jinnah, Nehru and the traditional bourgeois leaders of India. And the other aspect missing from official or known history of that movement was the role of the Communist Party of India in that movement. And even I think up to 1936, the Communist Party played an important role in leading that movement. And that has been obscured, that even they themselves, their own historians don't fully come out. The Communist Party was as strong, even stronger than Nehru and other leaders during the 30s and till 1943. But the Communist Party betrayed the national liberation struggle because Stalin, Churchill and Truman had two agreements in Potsdam and in Yalta, in which Stalin capitulated to British imperialism in the war, and what they were saying, a war of imperialism, they ultimately switched as a war of against fascism. And under instructions from Stalinist Moscow, the communists took a 180 degree turn. They started to support British imperialism, support the war effort. All the communists were released from the prison, and in fact they handed over the whole national liberation movement in a platter to the bourgeois leaders of the subcontinent. But we see that revolutions quite often arise from the wombs of war. And I think one of the biggest upheavals of mass upsurges, revolutions and stormy events was the post-Second World War period, not just in the colonial world, but also we see revolutions in Greece and Italy and France and in Europe and even the advanced countries. And at the time we saw a red storm sweeping across China, sweeping across South Asia and large parts of that region. And at that period, there was a big movement which started with the revolt of the sailors of the British Indian Navy that gave that really ignited a massive movement of the young proletariat that had developed in India across the subcontinent from Madras to Karachi, from Bombay to Lahore. The sailors took over the ship, they arrested the British officers, and then they called upon the workers in the railways, in textile, in other sectors to support them, and India was going out of the control of the British. And the bourgeois leaders at that time, Jinnah, especially Patel and Gandhi, they played a criminal role in crushing that movement. At that time, the commander-in-chief of the British Army, General Claude Auchinleck, he sent a telegram to the Whitehall in London saying that if you don't give them independence in 3 days, they will take it. But the tragedy was, because there was no leadership, the Communist Party had betrayed, that independence came not in the form of a united South Asia, united Indian subcontinent, because the British and the local bourgeoisie realized that a united national liberation struggle would not end up in a national liberation. It would move ahead and overthrow the system and go for a social and economic liberation. million innocent men, women and children were massacred in that bloody partition of 1947. 2.7 million. And partition was a bloody setback for the workers and the oppressed classes in that area. And they took a very long time to recover from that defeat of partition. Meanwhile, Pakistan and India came in existence. And at that time, because of the defeats of the revolution, the betrayal of social democracy and Stalinism, imperialism and world capitalism got a new lease of life in which they flourished, and the capitalism went perhaps through the longest boom in its history from 1948 to 1973. And this did have a certain spin-off effect in large parts of the colonial world, where there was a relatively faster industrialization and development of infrastructure. But Pakistan was a truncated state, and right from the start, this newly developed bourgeoisie tried to get a new market on the basis of Islamic religion, really failed to have a smooth and a positive growth and development on the political and on the economic sectors of society. And after a lot of political wrangling, just 10 years after partition and the creation of Pakistan, there was the first military dictatorship that was led by General Ayub Khan, who was a very close stooge of the British and the Americans. Are you happy? And in his first cabinet meeting, he said, there's only one embassy in Pakistan, and that is the American embassy. So you must, there's only one embassy in Pakistan, and that is the American embassy. So if you have to take any serious decision, you must consult that embassy. And Robert McNamara came in, other American advisors came in, they tried to create Pakistan on the lines of what General Douglas MacArthur had done in Japan, in South Korea, and in Taiwan. Because the bourgeois revolution in Japan was completed under the military boots of General Douglas MacArthur, and he crushed the feudals, and they, because they were afraid of what was happening in China, they couldn't stop the revolution in China, they couldn't stop the overthrow in China. So they put in special efforts and had parts of the Marshall Plan going there. To prop up Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, which we see today. But in Pakistan, the whole pattern of socio-economic development could not attain the levels or the gains of what they were able to carry through in Japan and South Korea and Taiwan. But there was massive industrialization, there was huge land reforms in the agricultural sector, there was a lot of investment, and the growth rate in that period was highest ever. Pakistan attained its highest growth rate of 9.5% ever in its history in the year 1969, and that was the year of the revolution. But that rapid growth created a huge, vast areas of masses coming from the countryside, peasants coming from the countryside, and it developed a huge, fresh, virgin proletariat. But due to the failure of that model to complete the tasks of the Industrial Revolution, it created more contradictions rather than solving the fundamental conflicts that were arising because of that rapid industrialization in society. And though on the surface there was stability, there was all peaceful growth, development, rejoicing of the ruling class, but underneath the surface there was a process, a molecular process developing, becoming more and more sharper as the time passed on and as the industry grew. And that culminated into a railway strike in 1967. It's a very interesting anecdote that the regime, they created a large train with models of different factories and industries and dams and all they had built in that period. And that train was supposed to rejoice a decade of reforms, what they called it, the decade of achievements, from Peshawar to Karachi of about 1,500 miles. They had to travel that exhibition train, didn't get it. The regime and the bureaucrats, they created a train, built a train on which there were models or miniatures of dams, of industry, of other projects that the regime had launched for 10 years. And that train was to have that exhibition passing through all the parts of Pakistan from the north to the south. And the ruling class was celebrating their victory. They were having a festival of their 10 years of success. But when that train reached south of Punjab, a station in the south of Punjab, there was spontaneous workers' rally. And they burned down the whole train. But as we say that revolutionary periods are historical exceptions, don't happen every day. And any single event at that particular, those particular moments in history when a lot of factors cut across or come into a particular equation, some event, some incident can explode a revolution. On 7th of November 1968, while the Stalinists were celebrating the Russian Revolution, lots of vodka at the Russian embassy, not far away from that, there was a young student, a polytechnical undergraduate, Abdul Hamid, who was killed in a police firing, police shootout. 68. And that one incident, it exploded a volcanic eruption that spread like wildfire throughout the country. And what we see that initially it was the students, not so much as the youth, as the students, the unemployment of the students that really were in the vanguard of the revolutionary process. And it was the students all across the colleges and universities throughout the countries who were the first ones to come out in protest against a regime against which there was simmering hatred underneath the surface. And another important aspect was women or female students played a very important role in most of the struggles and strikes of that period. And some of those women sent their bangles to the trade union headquarters of different unions in the railways and other sectors to make them ashamed that we are fighting in the revolution and you are sitting in your offices and the work trying to make the workers feel that they must come out, because a woman could do it, you could do it also. And in just days, in hours, so many events were taking place with such a rapid lightning speed that didn't take place for 20 years before that of Pakistan's existence. And the whole atmosphere was changed. You could smell revolution, you could really breathe revolution, you could feel revolution, that there was something in the air. You know, as Wordsworth, when he was in France in 1789, William Wordsworth, he said that bliss was in the dawn, but to be young was heaven. William Wordsworth, a British, William Wordsworth, an English poet, he was in 1789 in France during the revolution, and he's in his one of his verses he described the revolution that bliss was in that dawn, but to be young was heaven. Good. Yes. That's correct. I was 12 years old at the time of the 68th revolution, and still I have memories of how everything had changed, the moods had changed, the attitudes had changed, the people's relationships had changed, and people were really feeling that there is a hope. There was happiness all around. It was really a feeling of which cannot be described in normal times. we used to go out in demonstrations, hand in hand, moving forwards, fighting with the police. They were shooting tear gas at us, something, firing in the air. We went ahead, people went ahead again and again. And nobody knew you were in what you, whose hand you're holding. It's a man or a woman. It's a white or a black. It's a Muslim or a Jew. All those prejudices, you know, are just wiped away by the feeling that revolution instills in your consciousness in those historical moments. And we see the enormous courage that revolution gives to people who are totally different in an epoch before that. It totally transforms people's hearts and people's minds. And it instills enormous valor and bravery and courage amongst the leaders and who are totally different before those events start. We have a comrade who was the leader of that revolution in Karachi. His name is Usman Baloch. And when he was leading a mass rally of the workers on the main Karachi's main boulevard, the police had gone away. The rangers have gone away. It was the army and the tanks of the armored corps that had come. They were coming to stop or to terrify those who were demonstrating. And as the tanks were coming, the demonstration was moving directly in the opposite direction to those tanks. And the military officer, the colonel who was commanding that squadron of the armored corps, he came up to Usman Baloch and the other leaders. And he drew a line with chalk on the black tar road pavement. And told Usman and other leaders that you cannot cross this line. If you cross this line, then you will have to suffer. But the workers' demo crossed that line. Then he drew another line. They crossed also that line. Then he drew the third line. And when the workers crossed the fifth line, the tanks started to move back in reverse. There's another very interesting anecdote. The leader of the electricity unions, which was the largest union in Pakistan at that time and even today, He was a very timid, compromisist, opportunist, extreme. And he was always, you know, so subservient, so slavish to the bureaucrats, to the establishment. Astonishing. And then you can see how revolution instills, it totally changes people, it transforms their whole psychology. On 18th of February 1969, a general strike was called. Everything came to a standstill. It was a wheel jam strike. Wheel jam. Wheel jam. And that same leader, that frail, that timid, that coward, you know, he rang up the dictator, Field Marshal Ayub Khan. Phone. And he didn't call him Mr. President or anything. He said, Ayub Khan, your time is over. Get out now. That field marshal of the British Imperial Army, that field marshal from Sandhurst, that was trained in Sandhurst, who was a Pathan, Pashtun, he was just taken aback. He said, who the hell, who are you? Then he said, I am the General Secretary of the Electricity Workers Union. This, my name is Bashir Bakhtiar, blah, blah, blah. Ayub Khan was in a very furious rage. Rage, furious rage. He said, oh, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to annihilate you today. And the labor leader said to the field marshal, we'll see who destroys whom today. Now Pakistan has lot of load shedding, lot of electricity cuts in Pakistan these days by the crisis of the system and total breakdown of the infrastructure, power cuts. And there's a joke about the tragic country. There's a joke about the tragic country. That where do people get the happiest, the most? Where, in which country people are the most happy, happiest the most? They say Pakistan, because every day they become happy 12 times. In Pakistan, they're the happiest because they become happy 12 times every day. 12 times. Because there's hourly power cuts. And when the electricity comes, everybody says, oh, electricity has come, electricity has come. Rejoicing. And these power cuts are by the system, by the ruling classes. But on 18th of February, on the morning of 18th of February, 1969, the workers cut the power. At 10 o'clock, they cut the power of the government buildings and the Pakistan Secretariat. At 11 o'clock, they cut the electricity of the general headquarters of the Pakistan Army. And at 12 o'clock, they cut the president's house and the presidential palace, all the power supply. And at 1 o'clock, the mighty president called his cabinet and said, I think I'm going to resign. And in his last speech, Ayub Khan said, there's no point of me being in power anymore because today every major decision is being decided not in the government offices but in the streets, in the factories, in the villages. So the other important aspect is that what was the character of that revolution? What was the political nature of that revolution? Now, all the Stalinists and left call it an agitation, a struggle for democracy, a struggle against dictatorship. It was none of that. Because in those months, in that period, people who lived in the cities, they refused to pay rents of their houses. They refused to pay rents of their flats and their residences. They refused. The students and the youth refused to pay fares in the trains and the buses and other public transport. There were factory occupations in most parts of the industrialized cities. And in the countryside, there were massive struggles of the peasants who seized the lands and burned the palatial houses of the landlords in their landed estates. And such was the brutality of those landlords that in the northwest frontier, the peasants, when they used to go to the landlord, they had to kneel, not just inside the door, but right from the courtyard till the lounge where the landlord was sitting. And they had to kneel and go there with their heads down. When they were made to sit in courts, not straight up, but upside down. The courts were turned upside down and they were forced to sit on those courts to have been continuously humiliated and demoralized by those landlords. What? On the courts, you know the court, they put it like this, upside down, so that they should feel that these legs are higher than themselves.
Cots, not cots.
Well, the point I'm trying to make what do these steps in reality manifest and show is that the movement was not just to overthrow the dictatorship. It was challenging the relations of property. Property relations are challenged not in a democratic revolution, but they're challenged in a socialist revolution. They said they won't pay the rent because they said this is not your house, this is our house. This is not your train, this is our train. This is not your factory, this is our factory. This psychology shows that what was underneath that movement, which was moving to overthrow the existing relations of property and ownership. And the other important aspect is that the revolution did not come in a period of economic crisis or economic retardation. It came at the period of very high rates of economic growth. And in some of the primitive countries and societies, sometimes a certain level or a peculiar development of the economic growth can explode the existing contradictions which are present in that society. Now, but at that time, if you look at the political situation, all the Stalinist left, especially the pro-Moscow Stalinists, they were sitting with the right wing and even an Islamic fundamentalist party, and they formed a committee known as the DAC, the Democratic Action Committee, and they were demanding elections through the dictatorship. And at the same time, in the West Pakistan and East Pakistan, which is Bangladesh now, the two popular leaders who arose through that movement were Bhutto and Bhashani, who was a Maoist. He was a Maoist. And when the movement reached its peak, Bhashani was called over to Peking, which is now called Beijing, by Mao Zedong himself. Reprimanded and instructed by Chairman Mao that you are in a movement which is against our friend Ayub Khan, who was a very close ally of Chinese at that time, and you should immediately abdicate from this movement. And Bhashani came back. He went, used to live in a boat in Bengal, and he went into his boat and never came out. Into his boat, where he lived, and never came out of the boat. Bhashani, yes. And that was a big blow to the class struggle, because it was the first time in Pakistan's history that people of all religions, all nationalities, all ethnic backgrounds, all castes, all creeds had got together on a class basis. And from Peshawar to Chittagong in Bengal near the Burmese border, there is just one slogan, and that slogan was socialism, socialist revolution. And that's why later on nationalism emerged as a force, but I'll come into that later. But when the dictator fell in, on 25th of March, that was also one of the acts or events which vented a lot of steam. But the extraordinary thing of that revolution was that normally when the main target of the masses goes away, the individual or the dictator, the revolution sometimes recedes quite rapidly. But the 68-69 revolution, its momentum didn't weaken very much after that. And it was a condition of festivities, a carnival throughout the country. People came out on the streets, they rejoiced. And their resolve to transform the system, to overthrow capitalism, became even stronger with more confidence and more vitality. And that was a time between 67 and the revolution that Bhutto had a conflict with Ayub Khan. He was his foreign minister and he came into the opposition. He was prosecuted and he formed a new party in November 1967. Okay. And actually, if you look at that 30th November founding document of the PPP, it shows the character of that epoch, the strength and the influence the revolution was having on the politics of the country at that time. The 67. It calls for, it starts with the subject, the ultimate objective of the party's program is attainment of a classless society, which is only possible through socialism in our times. Then it calls for the expropriation of capital, expropriation of imperialist assets and loans, the dissolution of the standing army and the creation of People's Militia, and the reform and nationalization of all modes of production, distribution of land, abolishment of feudalism. It was a most radical manifesto or a program than any other communist or socialist party in the whole of South Asia. And now to deviate or divert the revolution, the ruling classes announced elections in 1970. They announced elections in 1970. And in those elections, some very interesting situations came to the fore, like what is the role of religion in societies like that? One of the most vicious fundamentalist parties today and even at that time, the Jamaat-e-Islami, was the main force of imperialism and reaction that was trying to, you know, oppose the revolution and
oppose the PPP. Its founder and its leader, whose name was Maududi, who was even a bigger so-called fundamentalist scholar than Abdul Wahab, who was even more biggest Islamic scholar than Abdul Wahab, you know, Wahab from Egypt, Wahhabis, the Saudis. You know. Now he came out of his the center of the Jamaat Islami and center of the Jamaat Islami party offices, and on one hand he had the Quran, and on the other hand he had bread. And he asked the crowd in front of on the main road that what you want, bread or the Quran. And the people said, we've got Quran at home, we've no bread at home. The people said, we have got Quran at home, but we don't have bread at home. And they say, we need bread, not Quran, you know. And the slogan of the PPP was, bread, shelter and clothing. That was the main election slogan. And when the elections were just approaching, all the Islamic parties, they called the biggest scholars, the scholar from Mecca, from the Kaaba, from the from Egypt, from Al-Azhar University in Egypt, all the biggest known scholars in the Muslim world, 13 of them came to Pakistan, and they issued a fatwa that whoever votes for the PPP or socialism will become an infidel and their marriage will break up. And all these people, you know, all these people, these intellectuals, they talk about, oh, religion is a big problem in Pakistan. Religion is important. We have to tackle it. We have to do this. We have to do this. Well, we tell them that in a theocratic state, in the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, infidelity beat and defeated Islam in 1970 election. That it was a clear fight between infidelity and Islam. That's how they put it, how they made it look like. And then people in that country voted for socialism against Islam massively. But even the elections could not stem the tide, could not stop the movement or the momentum of the revolution. Totally. Could not stop the movement, could not deviate it. But if in absence of a Bolshevik or a Leninist party, a Marxist leadership, it is always that revolution takes various forms and directions, and it deviates in other formations. because of the betrayal of Maoists in Bengal, the revolution entered into a nationalist phase against the nationalist exploitation by the West Pakistanis of the Bengalis in East Bengal. And the Pakistan army launched a brutal military operation to crush that movement in East Bengal. But such the movement it failed to die down, and the army gradually started to get defeated by the mass movement that had erupted after that revolution. By the mass movement that had erupted after the revolution, it started to defeat the Pakistan army. Instead of getting crushed, it fought back. And I think there's a very interesting turn of events in that period, when a movement that had started on a socialist, on a class basis, was deviated by the betrayal of the leadership on national lines. And again, when that national liberation movement against the Pakistan army started to defeat the army and conquer towns and villages and areas, again the class content of the movement came to the fore and the nationalist content went back. And those areas and towns which were liberated from the Pakistan army by the Bengali masses, in all the law and order, the police, the judges, the court, they were all collapsed. They all fell down. And that was a time when the Mukti Bahini, the guerrilla fighting force, and the GSD, the People's Socialist Party, they were leading that movement. They started to form Soviets in those areas. And those Soviets and councils, they made decisions of the courts. They acted as the preservers of law and order. And it was a very democratic structure, and there's a whole thesis being worked on the character, the functioning and working of those Soviets. Theft, crime and violence was almost eliminated in those areas where the state order had collapsed and the Soviets had taken over. And actually, what was happening in East Bengal was really threatening, not just for the Pakistani ruling class, they were, Pakistani state was being defeated, but also for the Indian bourgeoisie, and also for the United States imperialism, because if that process would have gone any further, it would have repercussions throughout the subcontinent. And the Indian army invaded East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, not to defeat the Pakistan army, as it is presumed or propagated, but to crush those Mukti Bahini panchayats or Soviets that were changing the existing social and state order that was prevailing and before them. And, you know, the relations between Indian and Pakistani, especially the military elites, were quite fine. You know, they were together in the British Indian Army as young officers, and now they are brigadiers or generals at this stage. And when, and on 17th of December 1971, when the Pakistan Army laid arms before the Indian generals, in the evening they had a big party in the Dhaka Gymkhana Club, in which Pakistan and the Indian, both the defeated and the victors, were together drinking lots of whiskey, because that's the tradition they got from the British. Next morning, they played a cricket match between themselves, which was also British tradition. And even Indira Gandhi was annoyed. She sent a telegram to her commander in Bengal, General Arora, that we have sent you to fight a war, not to play cricket. Indira Gandhi. Indira Gandhi. She sent a telegram to her Commander-in-Chief General, General Roda, that we have sent you to fight a war, not to play cricket. But imperialism was so worried that they thought that if that movement, that revolutionary upset in Bengal, could defeat the Pakistani army, they thought that it also could defeat the Indian Army. And the Americans sent the 7th Fleet in the Bay of Bengal. That in case the revolution spills over into West Bengal, which is an important state of India, and they speak the same language, they were artificially partitioned in 47, that which is already a bit pinkish, you know, that if West Bengal became red, if whole Bengal became red, then the revolution would sweep across the subcontinent. And the 7th Fleet was sent as a preemptive measure to invade Bengal if such a possibility arose. But neither the Indian Army nor the American intervention could have crushed or defeated that movement. It was ultimately defeated by its own leaders, betrayed by its own leadership, which sold themselves out to the Indians, connived with the Indians, killed the leading leaders of the left of GSD and the Mukti Bahini, and totally played a counter-revolutionary role to hold the movement within the limits of bourgeois national liberation.
But in the West Pakistan, which is present day Pakistan, even after all those events, there was still a certain revolutionary fervor going on, especially amongst the advanced proletariat in Karachi. Bhutto had meetings with Nixon and Kissinger in New York and another island, I don't remember the name. And then he was sent back to Pakistan for a transfer of power and to keep the situation in hold rather than going out of the control of the present state in the system. And Bhutto saved a defeated army, he saved the state, and he saved the system. But the pressure of the revolution was such, the ruling class was so terrified. Bhutto was himself so terrified that due to that momentum or that dynamic of the revolution, he had to carry through some of the most radical reforms in the history of the country. And by carrying through those measures, he even bruised some of the Pakistani capitalists, put them in, put some of the generals in. He tried to make big changes, but it could not have worked in a rotting capitalist system. But as the movement ebbed in the rest of the country, the vanguard in Karachi was attacked, and it was Bhutto who fired upon workers in different industrial areas of Karachi. Bhutto fired at the workers. And it was through the intervention of the state under Bhutto that those occupied factories and different industries were taken back, and the workers were brutally pushed out of those occupied industries. I think even at that period, after the defeat of the Pakistan army in the war, had there been a revolutionary party, had Bhutto even wanted to do something radical, it was possible with the army defeated, with the state in tatters, that they could have overthrown the state and even transformed the system. After that, there was another opportunity because after war and a defeat of a war, there was revolts in the army and there was a hatred of the masses towards the state and the system. And Bhutto was also sort of a Bonaparte. He tried to balance between different classes. Ultimately, the reforms failed. The capitalists unleashed inflation. The Bhutto government went into crisis. And he was removed and later assassinated by General Ziaul-Haq, who was Bhutto's own protege. He was deposed from power
and later on assassinated by a general Ziaulhaq, who was his own protege. And then there was an 11-year-old long, dark night of black reaction. In which the masses in Pakistan suffered heavily from the brutalities and the tyranny of Ziaulhaq. But again there was a movement in 1986, and Zia was killed by the Americans because he was becoming an obligation for them in 1988. But then Bhutto's daughter was not even Bhutto, she was even worse than that. She had actually congratulated and connived with the Americans long before she became the Prime Minister. But there have been several movements in Pakistan. There was movement in 81, movement in 83, movement in 86, movement in 93, movement in 2007. But of different intensities and different levels, but none of them has been to the level of 1968-69. And I think this tradition of 68-69 is the hope, and also shows that with that tradition, the new generation of workers and youth and peasants will rise once again to challenge the system. But this time there will be one fundamental difference. It's the presence of a relatively bigger IMT section in Pakistan. And I think that we are not going to let go another 68-69, no way. We are not going to let go another 68-69, no way. But we have a firm belief that another 68-69 will erupt. It will not be the same 68-69. History never repeats itself. History always repeats itself on a higher plane. And this time, the 68-69 from all aspects would be on a much higher plane, on a much more militant form and character. And our task is to build that factor which was missing in 68-69. And we are busy with that task and moving ahead.
Well, I'd like to thank Tanvir for that excellent lead-off. I'm sure that for many comrades, that was probably the first time I'm sure